substitutes that are full of aspartame that poison your brain, or who load it up with cream and so on that is very fattening. I know, I used to do that, and I weaned myself off of it, and anymore, I wouldn't even want to try to drink coffee or anything like that with all of those things in it. So,
well, I became a coffee drinker in college, and we were in a dorm, and we had no money for anything, so we always drank it black. So I never learned how to put all that stuff in my coffee.
Yeah. Well, and then we need to build satisfying meals, choose the kinds of things that we eat so that they are filling and satisfying. I think you've done a very good job here, Linda, in presenting us with this book, Press Pause Before You Eat. We need to say goodbye to mindless eating. We need to, like Daniel, purpose in our hearts that we're not going to defile ourselves anymore with the ways of the culture and bring ourselves under dominion. And we need to certainly be still and know that He is God. And I thank you so much for what you've done here. I trust a lot of people are going to be blessed by this. Friends, get a copy of the book. Your gift of $15 or more to Save America Ministries will put it in your hands. Call us 1-800-SAVE-USA. Want to urge you to become a partner with us. Day after day, we're preparing the way of the Lord for history's final hour, even today, because Jesus isn't coming back with a bride for spot, wrinkle, or any such thing. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Russell Blaylock, and we're going to be talking, or Dr. Blaylock's going to be talking, about the Obama health care bill. I sometimes refer to it as the Kevorkian health care bill, because the truth of the matter is, and what they're not telling you is, that the Medicare system is a Ponzi scheme. It was introduced back in 1965 for the Great Society. It was supposed to cost $9 billion. Actuarial figures said $9 billion by 1990. But by 1990, it really cost $90 billion. Today, it's somewhere between $350 and $400 billion every year. But, of course, they've been able to get by with this because a lot of money was coming in. There weren't that many people retired. And so a lot more money was coming in that was going out. And so that's how a Ponzi scheme works. And as long as you have more money coming in, well, you can keep putting the money out. But what happens when you don't get enough money in to cover all the money that's going out? Well, of course, the money that went out, the excess, was supposed to go into a Medicare trust fund. And, it was just like with Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff took the excess money over about what he was putting out, and he spent it on a lavish lifestyle. And here the congressmen in Washington, D.C., took the excess money from Medicare, and they spent it. They spent the money that was supposed to go into a trust fund. There is no money in a trust fund other than IOUs, which Congress had put in, that are backed by the financial stability of the United States government, that's having to borrow somewhere between $3 and $4 billion every day just to pay its debts. We don't have any money in the trust fund. We don't have any money to pay the IOUs. It's a Ponzi scheme, and they've got to do something, because they can't tell the American people that the members of Congress and the Senate have been lying to the American people about the stability of Medicare. And, of course, the big thing is that so many people are out of work, they're not paying into Medicare or Social Security, and the whole Ponzi scheme is coming down. Well, with that as a background, Dr. Russell Blaylock, thanks for so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, Stan.
Why don't you pick up the story? Because I know you've been studying a lot of fascinating things about this wonderful health care plan.
Well, yeah. In fact, I printed it up and read all 1,017 pages of it, and then went back and read certain sections again for even greater detail. And what I can tell you in general, just about everything you're hearing that's negative about this bill is true. You know, when I hear them say, well, there's no requirements for advanced care planning, that's a lie. It's in the bill. It says it's part of regular care. When they say that they're not going to put the private insurance companies out of business, and force you to give up your health care plan and push you in this public option, they're lying because it's in the bill. When they say that the doctors will be free and you can choose your doctor, well, it doesn't specifically say that you can choose your doctor, but the way it's worded for about 50 pages or more, they're going to own the doctor from the time he's trained in medical school through his internship and residency and throughout his practice. And we can go through some of these details about this, but it's spelled out in this plan, the absolute complete takeover, not just of medical care, but medical education. Every facet of health care in the United States will be taken over, which will be more than a sixth of the economic power of the United States will be confiscated by the federal government.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. You're right ahead, Russell.
Well, I want to go through some of the points that I took some specific notes on. You know, one of the things that's in this bill, there's a lot of special committees and trust funds. For instance, there's the Health Benefits Advisory Committee, there's the Health Choices Administration, there's Compliance Examination and Audit Committees, there's Health Care Comparative Effectiveness Research Trust Fund. All of these are allotted tens to hundreds of millions of dollars. Some of them are allotted billions of dollars that escalates every year, and that's just their estimate. As you said it during the introduction, this grows exponentially, far greater than anything that's ever predicted. So there's a lot of committees here and trust funds for collecting this this money. But let's look at the doctors, because I haven't heard a lot about what's this going to do to the doctors. And that's important to patients, because you want to be treated by a doctor who's free to treat you as he sees best, and as the doctor and the patient decide between them the best form of treatment. So what we see in this bill is that all physicians will be in the public option automatically. To leave, they have to specifically opt out. And it says in the bill that opting out will later be determined by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So the physician is going to have to apply to get out of this system. He's automatically included, or she's included. It says that the Secretary of Health and Human Services will determine the pay rates for physicians, and that this will be under constant review. And they're going to use the old DRG coding system to determine the physician's pay. Now, what's particularly frightening about this, it says the Secretary of Health and Human Services shall have the power to determine what constitutes overpayment. She'll have right to determine what the codes will pay, and that will change constantly. And she has the capacity to do what's called bundling, which means if a patient comes in and say they have pneumonia and a lot of other complications associated with it, and it takes a lot of physician time and work to get that patient well. What used to be, there were a series of codes, depending on the degree of difficulty.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Dr. Blaylock's just talking about how the government's going to control billing. They're going to control what the doctor gets paid, and they're going to constantly change that at their discretion. And in the past, of course, the doctors could bill for what he did. It's a very complicated case. Why, of course, he might take a great deal of time. There might be a number of illnesses that have to take care of. But now they're going to come up with a new alternative where some bureaucrat someplace is going to determine exactly what the doctor is going to be paid, no matter how many hours he put in. And we'll pick the story up there, Russell, because what you're describing is a nightmare. I mean, you certainly couldn't run an automotive shop this way, where some bureaucrat someplace was going to determine, well, there are a lot of things wrong with the car, but we're only going to pay for one of them, or we've got to cut funding someplace, so we just won't pay you for what you've done. But where in the world do they get the right, when a patient goes to a doctor, when the government's going to say exactly what the doctor will get paid? Because that means the doctor's working not to help the patient. If he is going to survive, he's going to have to do what the bureaucrats want, or cheat, or lie, or something of the sort. But go ahead.
Well, this bundling of codes, as you and I know, and most physicians know, the DRG codes was an absolute nightmare for physicians. They code every aspect of health care. Everything you do to a patient has a code number. And in order to apply for payment for Medicare or Medicaid, you had to submit exact codes that covered all the different aspects of that care for that patient. And it was very difficult to do because a lot of times there were no specific codes for what was wrong with your patient. If you miscoded, you were punished as if you had purposely defrauded the government. If they found a number of miscodings over the years, they went back, audited it, and then made you pay back the federal government. This could be $200,000 or $300,000. So by bundling codes, what they're doing is paying the physician far less. And as Stan said, this would be like taking your car in for bad spark plugs, and they find out, well, there's a bad transmission and you need new rings, and so he has to do a lot of work on your car, but they pay you just for the spark plugs. They bundle the whole thing and say, well, we're just calling it a general repair, and we're going to pay you what it would normally cost to fix the spark plugs. Well, physicians have tremendous office expenses. And the one thing about this bill, the amount of paperwork that's going to be added to the physician's work is absolutely enormous. As you read through this bill, you realize that what we've done through Medicare and Medicaid, which is a lot of paperwork and documentation, this is 100 times, 1,000 times more paperwork. Physicians will not be able to take vacations or have time off. They're going to spend all of their time documenting everything they do. Throughout this bill, it says every aspect of the care has to be fully documented to the satisfaction of the Secretary of HHS. This is going to produce an absolute nightmare. And, of course, it says also that the HHS can do constant revisions of the codes, which means you're going to have to learn all new codes every time they send out a new book. Now, what's dangerous about the AMA selling out the American physicians, which they've done consistently, is that the AMA has made a virtual fortune out of coding because they do the coding for the federal government. If the HHS is going to constantly be revising them, that means you're going to have the AMA selling you new coding books constantly. I figured out what the AMA would make just selling the coding books as they are now to every physician in the United States. They would make $144 million selling those books. But there's computer programs. There's just a lot involved in keeping up with everything. Now, it says throughout the bill there's penalties, civil penalties, all kinds of determination boards that you'll have to appear before. Even if you inadvertently make a mistake, there's no necessity that you intended to do it. It's just if it's inadvertent, you have to appear before these committees. You have to document and prove that you're innocent. Physicians won't have time to practice medicine or to keep up with new developments in medicine, because they're going to be poring over coding books and regulations to such an extent just to try to stay out of jail and out of huge financial penalties. It's an absolute nightmare for the physician. Well, as Dr. Monteith and I know, physicians now are just completely dispirited from what they're dealing with Medicare and Medicaid. The paperwork and the documentation is enormous. The fear of being arrested and put in jail for long terms over simple mistakes is constantly on the physician's mind. Now, I don't want a doctor operating on me that's under that kind of stress, and I'm sure no one else would either. But under this system, under this bill, that doctor will be under an enormous amount of stress. Now, it's, as I read through the bill, what I see in terms of the physician is they know a lot of physicians are going to retire early, and they're going to have trouble getting physicians to enter medical school and become doctors as they begin to see what this program entails. And they're planning on, as you read the bill, bringing in a lot of foreign doctors with foreign medical degrees from all over the world. They have special programs where they go to the disadvantaged parts of neighborhoods to specifically recruit physicians that will agree to practice medicine the way they want it to practice.
It sort of sounds like it is over in Great Britain. I've talked to people who've gone over there, and you go to a clinic or to a hospital, you can't find anybody who speaks English because they're all coming from Pakistan or India or other parts of the world. Finding an English-speaking doctor sometimes in an English hospital is very hard today because they've driven the doctors out.
Well, and British Health Service, in fact, did a survey to see if these foreign physicians were qualified to practice medicine. And what the government found was that only 30% of the physicians could pass even the most basic testing. So 70% of these foreign doctors were not fit to even practice medicine. But they were so desperate physicians that they just changed the qualifications so that they would meet it. Now, one of the other things, for instance, just to show how they rate physicians, you hear a lot about quality, and they say, well, we have special testing to make sure that the physicians are high quality. Well, under page 258, lines 13 through 17 on the HHS Secretary Evaluation of Physicians, and this is a direct quote, performance of eligibility of profession will, with respect to satisfactory submitting of data, or they're not qualified on the basis of how well they take care of patients, it's how well they submit the data to the Department of Health and Human Services. And if the physician does not meet the qualifications for submitting data, they will have to have an appeals determination, which, you know, you've got to get all your records together. You've got to appeal before a board of government bureaucrats to try to make your case that you're innocent.
And, of course, the thing is that what this is going to do is just literally either drive people away from medicine or drive them into a clinic where the clinic will do all of the work for them. But then, of course, the doctor will be working for the clinic and not for the doctor. And since the bottom line, it's all about cost-cutting and finance. It's not about taking care of patients. It's about paperwork. And it's about looking good, especially you can tell the best doctors because they're the most efficient. In other words, they spend as little as possible on trying to find out what's wrong with the patient or taking care of them. Well, I would think that the American people would be incensed to know what is really going on.
Well, and also, what this means is because the physician knows that every time he interacts with that patient, that's going to mean a lot of paperwork. You know, we all know, for instance, in the police situation, a policeman in some big cities won't make an arrest because he knows it's a lot of paperwork. So he just ignores a lot of crime. Well, here we have physicians under a system which says, if every time you treat that patient, you're going to have to produce an enormous amount of documentation. You're going to have to wade through interactions with bureaucrats in Washington and at different levels. You're going to go through a lot of headaches just to carry out the simplest treatment or any kind of treatment. So the physician starts thinking of ways not to treat patients. And this is what's going to happen. Somebody's going to come in and they're going to say, well, it's probably best we don't do anything about it. Just watch that. Because they know, well, if I order this MRI scan or if I do this particular test or this surgery, that's going to put me at high risk of being investigated and audited and a risk of civil penalties and having to appear before these determination boards. So the physician's inclination is not to treat. And that's what the government wants, of course. They don't want you treating the very sick patients, chronic patients, because it costs them money.
And the other thing is that every doctor occasionally will make a mistake, but if he makes a mistake, then, of course, he can be called before all sorts of boards. The easiest thing is, well, to cover for your mistakes. And if you may have to do some heroic things to pull the patient through, but there's a real disincentive to try to pull the patient through because then, of course, you'd have to explain the mistake. And what you're doing is creating a nightmare, not only for the doctors, but for the patients as well. So the doctor's whole framework is certainly, don't do anything. If you do anything, cover it up. And that's the way it was in the military. That's the way it is in every government department. Just cover everything up. And, of course, just try to get through doing as little as you can. And this is what the American people want. Well, the American people don't understand. They're told we're going to get quality health care and it's going to cost less. We can massively expand health care and we can dramatically cut the costs. Why, if we don't bring in Medicare, how are we going to be able to balance our federal budget? Ladies and gentlemen, you're talking about a nightmare worse than anything we've ever seen in medicine. We've known it. We become a remembrance of things past. Go ahead, Russell.
Well, another example of how...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. 800-282-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Raise taxes on them. I am not going to raise taxes on you. It's only on those rich people making over $250,000 a year who could afford to pay a little bit more to help the people. Well, of course, maybe he hadn't read his own tax bill, his own health bill, because Dr. Blaylock is saying that many of you decide that you're not going to take health insurance. You as an individual are going to be taxed 2% of your income. And then, of course, if your employer suddenly doesn't take out the health insurance for you, why, he's going to be taxed 8%. And then if you are a wealthy person who actually decides you don't want to take out the health insurance, how much is that going to cost you?
Well, there's an added tax. If you have $1 million, there's 6% added on top of the 2.5%. So you're paying 8.5% cost. And it's graded according to your income. For instance, $250,000, $300,000, there's a 2% added on top of the 2.5%. And then if you go up to a little bit higher above $300,000, it goes up to 4.5%. And so it just keeps rising up into $1 million. So there's a surtax just for the fact that you're a more successful person. And you've decided, I can take care of my health care out of pocket. Well, the government is saying, well, you can't pay it out of pocket. We're going to punish you for that. There's a lot of punishment in this bill. The other thing that's particularly frightening about this bill is you'll read throughout it. A lot of things are left up to the discretion of the Secretary of Health and Human Services. You'll read in there, it said the actual regulations will be determined 18 months after this bill is passed. So you're passing a bill for which the regulations have not even been written. Another section will say the rules and regulations for this subsection will be made in 1 year. So, again, you've passed a bill for which the regulations were not even written. So when you hear Obama or his people saying, well, that's not in the bill, well, the bill is an open door. The Secretary of Health and Human Services, under their control, and put anything in the bill they want to because the bill says it's up to their discretion. We see this, you know, when Sarah Palin made the comment about the death panel. Well, death panels is not mentioned in this bill, but it's open to the discretion of the Department of Health and Human Services to create death panels if they so choose, because it says advanced life planning will be done as a part of regular health care. Well, there goes the lie of Obama saying that this is not mandatory. Well, it says it's part of regular health care and it will be done every 5 years. And that if the patient develops a chronic illness or an acute illness or an injury that could be life-threatening, then the patient has to be evaluated even sooner for discussions of whether you want to continue to give life-saving health care. Now, that is in the bill, but it also gives the Secretary of Health and Human Services the option of changing these end-of-life determinations at any time. So she could very well, within a year, 18 months, institute a death panel, if she so choose, which could go through nursing homes and say, a panel of physicians and bureaucrats decide whether grandma lives or dies. That is allowed in this bill, and anybody says it isn't is lying.
But, you know, one of the things that really disturbs me, Russell, is that they talk to people about, well, you wouldn't want extraordinary, if you were facing death, you wouldn't want anything extraordinary done, would you? And, well, most people are thinking, you know, imagining being on a respirator for the rest of their life, but extraordinary can include water. It can include food. I mean, after I've heard them actually talking at the medical meetings about, well, when an older person comes into the hospital, the emergency room, if you start an IV on them, why, of course, then we're going to have to discontinue the IV if it doesn't look like kind of make it. So maybe you'd be better off not to start the IVs when they come in, the older people, because, you know, they might be going to die, and if you start the IVs, you're going to have to continue giving them the IVs, and nobody knows whether they're going to live or die. But there really are people out there who have a different worldview, who do not value human life, who feel that there are too many older people out there anyway, and you really want the decisions to be made by a panel of other people, but that use of extraordinary, care at the end of life, people don't understand. That may be as simple as water or food.
Or exactly. You see, in this bill, what it says that the patient, once they're in for these evaluations, we will be given access to all videos, pamphlets. They will be connected with national and state-specific resources and community organization, which opens it up to ACORN. They can do it.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. This is Dr. Stan back here, and of course our guest is Dr. Russell Blaylock. And Russell, go right ahead.
Well, one of the things that really concerned me about this advanced care planning, it also provides for the training of healthcare professionals in doing advanced care planning. And like you say, what happens is they go into this training and they tell the physician, well, when you see this patient, what you need to tell them that they have a terminal condition or a life-threatening condition, or they're chronically ill and probably not going to recover completely, and they're going to be a terrible financial burden to their family, and that it would be best if they wrote an order, had an order on the chart saying that we will do no such life-extending treatment. Well, that's going to put a lot of guilt on that elderly person, because they don't want to be a financial burden to their family. And there's nothing in the bill that says the family will be present, because the family may say, well, we don't care. I don't want my father dying at this time. And as a neurosurgeon, I treated a lot of very sick patients. And many times I had patients that would be admitted through the emergency room, and in the emergency room evaluation, they'd say, well, oh, there's no chance this person can live. And that was by a physician who had no neurosurgical training, and I would evaluate the patient. I said, well, they can't. And I would admit them and operate on them, take a blood clot off, give them rather intensive treatment, and they would return to useful function, go back to their family and be perfectly okay. But if it was left up to that primary care physician, they would have let the patient die. I remember one man I had that came in was severe brain injury, and I gave him very intensive treatment. Everybody thought that he was hopeless and I should have let him die. It took months of therapy. He recovered, and he was a young man, and even graduated from college. Many times in my career, I've seen people who would have been declared unsalvageable by lesser-trained physicians, not a neurosurgical specialty, a house officer or a family practitioner,
Hold that thought, please. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Dr. Russell Blaylock. And, Russell, before we go on, because we were talking about the problem that doctors have determining when end of life comes. And one doctor, not experienced, could say, oh, I'm sure they're going to die. You know, there's just no way that they're going to be able to survive. But certainly a lot of these people can survive. But you see, the government doesn't want them to survive. Why? Because it's just so expensive. There are too many. Many older people. It costs a lot of money to keep older people alive, and they don't want to put the money out. They want to be able to spend it on their wars and all their other government programs, and they're really not interested in the elderly people, and they've got their support through the Medicare program, but the Ponzi scheme is out of money, and they're not going to tell the American people. They've been lying to them that it is a Ponzi scheme, and they've got to come up with a solution, and the solution is, well, if they just die off, then we don't have to worry so much. Russell, before we go on, would you like to get your webpage out so people would be able to get your information, and tell them about your newsletter before we go on?
Yes, they can go to my website, which is russellblaylockmd.com, RussellBlaylockMD.com. It has free information, but also access to my newsletter, which is through Newsmax magazine, and this gives health information on how to treat yourself with nutrition and other natural remedies that can prevent you from having to enter hospitals and prevent disease from happening in the first place. You know, I'm really concerned, having practiced medicine and neurosurgery, very intensive type medicine, for many years, because I have seen this process whereby if you let primary care physicians, and this bill even says that a physician's assistant and a nurse practitioner can sign the orders. Doesn't even have to be by a physician. These people will determine that someone is incurable or not salvageable. Who is very well salvageable. It happened to my mother. My mother was in a hospital in Louisiana and on the weekend, admitted on the weekend. And I went over there, and there was not a physician in sight. Nobody saw her. I tried to call the physicians. They couldn't contact them. They wouldn't come in to see her. She was slipping into a coma. I took her out of the hospital, had her transferred to my hospital, had a friend of mine operate on her, and she made a full recovery, lived another year, very happy, and she would have died that night. That was because she was a Medicare patient, and they felt like, well, she's elderly, and she's slipping into a coma. Why should we waste any time with her? And this is a physician's mother. So you can imagine what your chance would be being in this public health option with physicians, assistants, nurse practitioners, and family practitioners making these life and death decisions, particularly if they go through training courses by the federal government, and they're exposed to pamphlets and other informational sources that are regulated by the government. Now, 5% of the health care on the elderly is costing 50% of the cost. That's because the elderly have a lot of chronic disease, a lot of complex diseases, and require a lot of work by physicians and hospitals to get them well. But as I wrote in one of my papers called Social Utility, Is Grandpa and Grandma Worth Saving? In this paper, I show that, you know, our elderly people are a tremendous source of wisdom for our society. They've lived through some of the most important eras of our country. They're witnesses to history. And if we just start letting them die and killing them off through neglect, we're going to lose a tremendous amount of this wisdom. You know, the whole concept of social utility, if you look back in the eugenic literature back in the 1900s, 1910, 1920s, much of that was based on the fact that certain people in society have no worth. And they came up with the term social utility. Now, what it says is that to live in this country, you must show that you have some worth. If you don't have worth, we'll kill you. And that was a very popular conception among intellectuals in that period, not only in Germany, but in the United States as well. This was a growing idea among the intellectuals that people should have to establish their worth. And in fact, they even worked out a formula where your worth was more than what the government had to pay for your care or your existence. And if you didn't meet that positive balance, then the state should have the right to end your life. Well, this whole idea is gaining in strength again. We're seeing our intellectuals, our really powerful, influential people, are again captured by this thought that people must have social utility or we need to eliminate them. And that includes the disabled, because they consider the disabled of no real use to society. If you read Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, who is the health czar for the Obama administration, he's a member of the Hastings Center. He's a fellow. And in this, he says that, you know, a person should essentially establish their social utility. If not, we should not give them health care. We should make sure that they meet their end quickly.
Now, that, of course, is Rahm Emanuel's brother, isn't it? He's the chief of staff for the Obama administration, and his brother, the health czar, is the Hastings Institute. Now, what is that tied in any way to Dr. Kevorkian?
Well, the Hastings
yes.
Center is not directly connected to him, but they agree with his program. And what I tell people, you know, who say, well, I can't believe that anybody in our government would be in favor of killing the elderly. Well, you would be surprised what's written. If you read the Hastings Center literature, they even talk about redefining freedom. That we've got to redefine it so that people understand this social utility idea, and that we need to have distributive justice, which means there's a certain amount of money we need to give it to the young people, the people that are healthy and strong. It's a Darwinian idea, the idea of the strong and the fit are the ones that deserve life, and those that are unfit and weak need to be eliminated.
That sounds very much like the Nazi concepts, you know, that certainly there were lives that were not worth living, and that, of course, how they began their downhill slide into the Holocaust. But they really started initially not with the Jews, but with the elderly, the infirmed, the insane, the mentally defective. They were the ones who were either sterilized or killed initially in Germany, and then it was only a short step there to the Gypsies and the Jews, and eventually to the Christians.
Well, if you read the literature, the eugenics literature in Germany, the vast majority of it was written from about 1898 until the 1910, 1920, long before Hitler was even known. And it had spread among the university professors, among famous surgeons, particularly in the psychiatric profession, and they were openly expressing the idea that these people don't deserve life, and several, you know, like Ernest Haeckel, were promoting the idea we need to do mass sterilization, we need to legalize abortions, we need to have euthanasia to get rid of these people that have no social utility, no purpose. So this was long before Hitler. The German society was very excited about this, and it was accepted. It was in all the newspapers and pamphlets and books. Multi-volumes were written on it by very famous writers. And when you look at the American literature during the same period, We see universities like University of California, Caltech. We see University of Chicago, Harvard, Johns Hopkins University, Columbia. They were all staffed by professors who believed in this Darwin idea and were saying the same thing the Germans were, that we need to get rid of what they called the human weeds. They said, just like a garden, you've got to get the weeds out of it. Well, they considered disabled, the elderly, the chronically ill, the incurables as weeds that had to be gotten rid of. And in fact, one of the famous ophthalmologists went on a campaign to have bills before the New York legislature, which he submitted several, to have people who were blind forcibly sterilized. Even though only 7% of them had hereditary blindness, he said all blind people should be sterilized. Well, then it went to the next step. Well, not just blind people, but people who have poor vision. And in his bill, it said that you would pay people's neighbors to spy and see if people had poor vision. And they would be rounded up by authorities and forcibly sterilized. All of this was openly being promoted by some of our biggest universities and very powerful people in our government. Even Theodore Roosevelt agreed with it. So it was not something that arose in Nazi Germany. It arose long before. What happened is Hitler was convinced by this literature. He believed in the Darwinist idea, and he believed in this racial hygienics, which was so popular in both the United States and in Germany. So he grew up in this intellectual milieu of eugenics, and that's where he got his ideas, and even they can trace intellectually the origin of his ideas in these universities and pamphlets and books that he read. But people just don't know that. Now, there's a book called From Darwin to Hitler, written by Richard Weikert, which is an excellent history of the influence of Darwinism and how it ended up with Hitler. And he talks about Ernest Haeckel, and that Haeckel complained that not only many mentally ill persons burden to society, but so are lepers, cancer patients, and others with incurable illnesses. Why not spare ourselves much pain and money, he asked, by just giving them a shot of morphine? And he recommended a commission of physicians to make the final decision, but the individual being reviewed had no choice whatsoever. The physician would decide whether they lived or died. So here you see back in Ernest Haeckel's day, which was in the 1880s, 1890s, these proposals being made of death panels. Well, it caught on, and there were quite a few very powerful and prominent people in Europe who picked up his ideas and promoted even infanticide, that we should be able to kill infants if they were unfit. Now we're seeing a resurgence of these ideas in our society and in our intellectual centers. More and more people are convinced by the idea that, in fact, there are undesirables in our society that cost us too much, and they have no social utility, so it is perfectly rational on a Darwinian philosophy to eliminate those people from society, and that's what this bill does. This is the most Darwinist bill you could imagine, because it's based on survival of the fittest and the idea of man engineering human evolution, which if you read all of this early literature, that's exactly the words they use, that man, the wise people of society, needed to engineer human evolution and through human engineering. The Rockefeller Foundation poured millions of dollars, as did the Carnegie Foundation and later the Ford Foundation, and this objective, that is human engineering, to create the perfect man. Well, you know, the history of molecular biology written by Lily Kay, she says modern biology, molecular biology, grew out of this quest by the Rockefeller Foundation and other foundations to create the perfect human and to get rid of the diseased people, but to do it through a more scientific and subtle method than was used with the early eugenics programs, which was rounding up people, putting them in concentration camps, forcibly sterilizing them. Well, in Germany, for instance, they euthanized 70,000 people. In the United States, something like 38,000, as many as 50,000 people were forcibly sterilized.
But, you know, Russell, most Americans don't understand that. That is never mentioned by the media today. And one of the big problems is that the average American doesn't understand there really are people who feel this way today. I mean, we ridicule Dr. Kevorkian, but there are many people who embrace those concepts. The people of Oregon have already voted as to allow doctors to euthanize patients. And once you actually allow that, why then it's only a matter of, well, are they really terminal, or maybe they want to die, or maybe they should die. People today do not understand that both the Netherlands and Denmark today, there are many of the older people who are afraid to go to the hospital. And they're afraid to go to the hospital because they know they'll be killed. People say, that couldn't happen in modern-day society. Well, it not only could happen, it is happening, and certainly several articles in the Internet are pointing out that a certain significant percentage of the people in who are euthanized over there in the Netherlands and in Holland and Denmark don't want to be euthanized. But it's done anyway as part of the government health care delivery system. And one of the gentlemen with a pro-life, Dr. Wilkie, I don't know if you know him, but he talks about talking to the doctors over there who tell him they're so concerned that this is really going on. Well, if it could go on in a civilized country like Denmark or Holland, could it go on here? And it sounds to me like we're making the first steps along the way towards that ultimate goal. Ladies and gentlemen, this is, most people haven't read this bill, but Russell has. You need to get the information. You need to help us get it out. We need to defeat this legislation. Our guest is Dr. Russell Blaylock. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Russell, go right ahead.
Well, you know, talking about civilization.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
Well, you know, America is changing, but most of the changes that are taking place seem to be designed to take away our freedom. And what can you do to remedy the current situation? Well, you can become informed, and one of the best ways to become informed is to subscribe to Republic Magazine, because that magazine provides the information that's suppressed in most other news magazines. If you want to oppose the effort to establish a one-world government, if you want to preserve freedom here in the United States and throughout the world, I suggest you subscribe to Republic Magazine, and you can do that by calling 1-800-873-1620. That's 800-873-1620 or access their website at www.republicmagazine.com. That's republicmagazine.com. I suggest you get extra copies for your family and your friends.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-
Dr. Emmanuel Sidney, who is the health czar for the Obama administration. He is the brother of Rahm Emanuel, who is the chief of staff there. And Dr. Emmanuel has written extensively about the end-of-life care and many of the papers coming out of the Hastings Institute, where he is a fellow, talk about, we should simply convince the elderly that they've lived long enough and the money cannot be spent for them. There are limited resources, and they're going to have to face the fact that there comes a time to die. Why would you keep emphasizing that? I'm 80 years old. I don't want to hear that I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die someday, but I don't want some government bureaucrat telling me they don't have the money to take care of me. When I went into medicine, we had a system of county hospitals, and nobody was ever killed for utility reasons. People died, but we did everything we could to preserve human life. But they intentionally shut down the county hospital system. They've created a crisis situation. They've centralized all power in Washington, D.C., and now they can do what they've always wanted to, and that is begin to eliminate human life. There really are people out there who do not believe in the sanctity of human life, because they don't believe in God. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment here for the second hour with Dr. Russell Blaylock, but this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters so we can bring you the information you're not going to get through the controlled media. And ladies and gentlemen, the media is controlled in America. It gives you the information they want you to hear, and if you don't believe that, just turn on your radio or television every evening, and you hear all these stories about the threat of swine flu. Well, the threat of the swine flu epidemic is totally contrived. They talk about it on ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, over and over and over again. And they're not telling you that certainly far more people die every year of being struck by lightning than have been killed in this entire swine flu epidemic throughout the entire world. But they're not going to tell you that. I mean, certainly they're just suppressing the information so the average individual really doesn't understand. So basically, we do hope that many of you out there will suddenly give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927, and then we do hope that many of you out there will want to get our fourth CD set on the swine flu vaccine, You better understand what this is really all about. Because, of course, to this date, and here we are just about 6 weeks before it is going to be, they're starting a massive vaccination program to vaccinate millions of American citizens and billions of people throughout the world. They will not tell us what is in the vaccine. They will not tell us whether it will contain squalene. They've distributed the squalene, but they won't tell us whether they're going to put it in the vaccine, because they're deciding what they're going to do with this massive program, and they don't know. At least they know, but they're not going to tell us common people. And then, of course, we do hope you want to get our four tape sets on vaccinations, vaccine update 2009, And then, of course, we have an excellent DVD with Dr. Blaylock. It's called Vaccines and Brain Development, a talk that Russell gave at our conference last October. And the year before that, we had Dr. David Ayoub, who gave a talk on mercury autism and the global vaccine agenda. Mercury autism and the global vaccine agenda. And there's a free CD-ROM that comes with the DVD that simply gives you a well over 1,000 pages of scientific studies and government documents showing they know that the mercury in the vaccines is harmful, and they're lying to the American people. And, of course, we do carry the Simpson Wood Report. You can get it off the Internet, but we actually have published it and is available to Radio Liberty. So, again, our number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, our webpage, radioliberty.com. You could listen to our programs there 4 hours a day live, and then please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily that. Those are the owners, management, staff, sponsors of the station you're listening to. They're my views and the views of our special guest this evening, Dr. Russell Blaylock. I wanted to open this session with a quotation that comes from a book called The Legacy of Malthus. It's out of print now, but it certainly opens with a quotation from Elie Wiesel, who was actually a victim of the Holocaust. He survived, but this is what he wrote. Spring 1945. Emerging from the nightmare, the world discovers the camps, the death factories, the senseless horror, the debasement and absolute reign of evil. Yes, it is possible to defile life and creation and feel no remorse, to tend one's garden and water one's flowers, but 2 steps away from the barbed wire, to experiment with monstrous mutations and still believe in the soul and immortality, to go on a vacation, be enthralled by the beauty of a landscape, and still fulfill regularly, day in and day out, the duties of a killer. Those engaged in its practices didn't belong to a gutter society of misfits, nor could they be dismissed as just a collection of rabble. Many held degrees in philosophy, in sociology, and in biology and general medicine, psychiatry, and the fine arts. There were lawyers among them, and unthinkable but true, theologians. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we have at Princeton University, in charge of the Department of Ethics, a gentleman named Peter Seeger. Peter Seeger is a professor there who thinks that children should be, well, you parents should be able to kill their children up to 3 years of age. He sees nothing wrong with that if the parents decide up to 3 years of age they don't want to have that child. They should be able to kill it. This is at Princeton University, where once, of course,
ministers of the gospel, of the Christian gospel, were trained, and missionaries were trained to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ. But as with so many of our other universities, they've been taken over by people who have a different world view. And if there are people like world with that sort of a world view today, do you want to give those people the life and death decisions over your life or the life of your loved ones? Russell, pick up the story.
Well, all of these things that you've just quoted and said is what people need to understand about the debate that's occurring today. You know, all of this is based on a worldview. And as I tell people, there's two basic worldviews. One is the Gnostic worldview, and the other is the Christian worldview. The Gnostic's view is that certain men, because of their connection to their divinity, and their divinity is Lucifer, this is from ancient writings of Gnosticism, said that certain men are endowed with wisdom. These are the New World servers, and their job is to rule the world, to tell the people of the world what they should do and not do. And as Eric Voegelin, one of our great political philosophers, has written extensively on this, and he brings this to date, and he shows that virtually every political movement that is not Christian is based on this Gnostic idea that certain wise men have been chosen to rule the world. And they truly believe this. And if you look at the attitude of the modern politician in this debate, that's their worldview, that the people just don't understand what we understand. We know how to rule society. We know what's best for you. We know what would make a better world. All you have to do is do what we say. And of course, because they see themselves as endowed with...
Hold that thought, we'll be right back here. Go right ahead. You were just saying, because these people with a Gnostic worldview see themselves with, well, they're above us common people. But go right ahead.
Because they're endowed with this wisdom, this power, everyone should listen to them. It is your duty to carry out what they say. Now, recently, you've heard some controversy about Obama addressing the children at school, and the National Education has produced this booklet of questions that the students are supposed to study after the president gives his address, and it's going to be repeated addresses. And one of them is to have the student write when a certain problem comes up in America, how can we help the president? What should we do to aid the president and what he's trying to do? Well, that's the concept that the president is one of these wise chosen ones, and we work for him. Our duty is to do what he says and to regiment ourselves into carrying out his wise program. When it's just the opposite of what the founding of this country said, the president works for us. We tell him what we want. We tell our congressmen what we want. It's not the other way around. But you're seeing now a different political philosophy based on this Gnostic idea that, in fact, it is the collection of wise ones. Now, if you look at the writings of David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the major movers and shakers in this world, the theme you get repeatedly is that they're very, very wise, and that they are designing a better world, and that if we'll follow their design, if we'll do our job that they outlined for us, they'll create a utopian world for us. But if we resist, then we'll have to be taken care of. Now, that's actually expressed in Alice Bailey's writing. She even says that people who resist will have to be taken care of. And she said, For our other followers, it's not your duty to do that. It is our duty to take care of these resistors. We're seeing this arrogance of these chosen wise ones are handing down these edicts to the masses of people.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Dr. Blaylock's just talking about this philosophy of the elite, that they know what's best for us common people. He was quoting certainly people like David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, Zygmunt Brzezinski, who, in their writings, make it very clear that they are the wise ones and that we should be grateful to them. In fact, those of you who haven't read David Rockefeller's memoirs, why we do carry it, we think it's important for you to understand the close relationship between David Rockefeller's daughters and Fidel Castro and David Rockefeller, when Fidel Castro comes up to visit with the boss, but of course the common people aren't supposed to understand. But on page 405, David Rockefeller talks about how a lot of the people on the left and the right want to accuse the Rockefeller family of having a tremendous influence over society and government, and of course some of them even believe that they're part of a secret cabal that is working against the best interests of the United States to promote a new international order. And then David Rockefeller goes on to say, and if that is the charge, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it. And then he goes on to say something very interesting. He said, the populace, speaking very demeaningly of them, common people like you and me, the populace certainly, they never talk about what a great job we've done. I mean, look and see what's happened in the third world countries where the standard of living has gone up. Look and see what's happening in our own country where things are so much better. Now, remember, he's writing in 2002, and of course, things were better in the third world countries. Things were a lot better in China than they were, a lot better in India, as we've transferred our wealth and our jobs and our manufacturing over there. But since they were willing to take full credit for all the good things that have happened, are they willing to take credit for the bad things that are happening today as the economy of the world is collapsing and more people are losing their jobs here in the United States, and there are between 25 and 30 million Americans who are either unemployed or underemployed, and certainly 4 or 5 million people have either lost their homes, but probably another 10 million will lose their homes before this is over. Could those things, are they willing to accept responsibility for that? Well, they're not going to accept responsibility for that, although they're the ones who brought it about because they are the ruling elite. And what is so amazing, Russell, is that these people are totally dedicated to population control. In fact, the Rockefeller Foundation has really financed the population control movement. They're even financing. They're storing all the seeds up above the Arctic Circle in vaults off one of the Scandinavian countries, getting the wheat and the corn and the other types of food substance seeds so that they'll be there when we start all over again after what they have in store for us. But they believe they know what's best for the world. But you go right ahead.
Well, that's exactly right. And here's a quote I found in the book by Weikert, From Darwin to Hitler, that I thought was very appropriate and sort of focuses our attention on the main problem, the central problem here. He says, the increasing secularization of Europe of European thought in the 19th century, in tandem with Darwinian ideas, opened the door for racial extermination by sweeping aside traditional Christian moral objections and by reducing humans to soulless organisms. And that's exactly what we've done. And if you look at what happened in history, two things occurred very close. One was Darwin's writings appeared and was widely accepted by the scientific community. And the second was the appearance of the writings of Karl Marx, assaulting society. Now, the reason Karl Marx's socialism took off in the world when other socialist writings were generally ignored and socialism made very little inroads at that time was because Marxism was attached to science. He sold his form of socialism as being scientific. And at the time, in this Enlightenment period of science, people were so enthralled with it that you couldn't argue with science. And that was all, that became the mantra of, well, you can't argue with the science. So he knew that if he attached his socialism to science, it'd be very difficult for people to argue against it, because you're arguing against scientific fact. He linked it to Darwinism, which gave it even more power. And this is, in my estimation, is why the people that are in power will not let Darwinism even be questioned, because it is absolutely essential to the survival of socialism. People have to believe, number one, that human beings are animals. They have no soul. There's no afterlife. There's no God that cares about you as an individual. And therefore, man is on his own. And that there's certain people in the world, these wise ones, that are going to have to save us. And if we'll listen to the people of wisdom, we can be saved. If we don't listen to the people of wisdom, there's no one else to turn to, because we're all alone in the universe. Well, the science, in link with Darwinism and Marxian socialism, has driven this philosophy home. So today, a large segment of the world firmly believes this. There's very few people who still, I'm talking about in the world, who believe in the Christian principles, the primary foundations of Christianity, that our morality is transcended. It's not man-made, that we have a soul, that God cares about us as individuals, and he hears us when we pray. These are the fundamental foundations of our belief system, but they're under tremendous assault because they give this scientific air to Marxism. And much of what you see in our society today, particularly under the Obama administration, because they're so steeped in this worldview, this Gnostic worldview, is that they're making a very concerted push to get us totally into the Marxian, scientific, Darwinian socialist system. They're impatient. They've been waiting a long time, giving us this ad hoc socialism a little bit at a time. And they see that the end game is here, that they can take the world and accomplish what they want to. So they no longer hide the fact that they want to destroy American sovereignty, or that they think of people only as a society and not as individuals, or that they embrace socialism, and that they believe that our God does not exist. And they're making concerted, open efforts to destroy Christianity, where all of these things were hidden as short as 40 to 50 years ago. You would never hardly find a politician who would even admit he was a liberal, or less say that he was from the left. You would never hear politicians talk about these draconian controls of society, and that people must establish their utility or they cannot live in the society any longer. But now we're hearing these things openly, because they feel they're so close to grasping that power that they need and extending it over the entire earth. Well, our Bible warned us of this. It told us to beware of people who felt that they had wisdom, that this person of wisdom, and of course is the whole story of Adam and Eve, is trying to supplant God, saying that I have the knowledge of God of good and evil, and therefore you no longer need God. Well, that was the original crime that led man to his downfall and the need for a Savior. And all of this is quite serious, because you see that's the division in our world between these two beliefs, and that's the real battle. And as I talk to people, you know, they want to talk politics, they want to talk economics, but I tell them, you know, it's beyond all of that. it's the clash of these two worldviews, and one is going to win out. And our Bible says that Christianity is going to win out in the end. So, you know, I feel comfortable overall, even though we're facing this enormous enemy, because we're far outnumbered, and the Bible constantly tells us that we're far outnumbered and that we will be massively outnumbered toward the end.
Well, you know, for our listeners out there who question what Dr. Blaylock is saying, we have a little pamphlet that's put out by the people on the other side. It's called The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy. It was written by Alice Bailey, who actually got her a book. She wrote, I think, 20, 24 books, something like that, 25 books. They were all channeled to her by a demonic spirit named Joao Cool. But here is a little pamphlet that comes from her book, The Externalization of the Hierarchy, where she actually talks about the workings of the spiritual hierarchy that rule the world. And she's very, very open about it. There is a group of people who really rule the world, and there always have been, but they were totally in place in the 1950s. And you really need to get that. It's available through Radio Liberty. Order anything else from us. Why? We'll be glad to send it to you free of charge, The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy. And we are really involved in a spiritual battle being played out on a political, cultural, ideological, even financial battlefield. And there really are people who are on the other side who do not believe in God. I mean, we're told, you know, we're either going to be ruled by the Bible or we're going to be ruled by the bayonet. It's certainly those will not be ruled by God, we will be ruled by tyrants. And that's exactly the way we're going. And the average person doesn't understand. Our form of government was made for a moral and religious people. Are we really a moral and religious people today when we're the largest exporter of pornography in the world? Watch, you know, your television programs. For all the sexual innuendos and popularization of immorality and degeneracy, we'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Blaylock.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Figure that the average individual is never going to take all the time to research all their material, and certainly you're not going to hear about this from 60 Minutes or 2020 or on ABC or CBS or NBC, because they're controlled by these people. And the purpose of the media today is not to reveal the truth, but to conceal the truth. And the last thing they want is for the people here in America to wake up to what's going on before it's too late. Go right ahead, Russell.
Well, one of the things, just to give you an example of the things they write about in their papers that they know most of the public will never read because they're in scholarly journals. For instance, a professor Callahan, who's also a fellow at the Hastings Center, wrote that serious progress would mean turning back the clock. He's talking about medical field. Advocating in his paper that what we've done, we've created too good of a medical care system. And so we need to turn the clock back so that it's not accessible to most people in the society. It's limited to people that they've chosen. And, of course, that means getting rid of most of the elderly, certainly getting rid of the chronically ill, people with presently incurable diseases, because they have no use to these wise planners. They have no social utility whatsoever. And they're a burden, as they see it, on their new society. And it goes even further, and another paper from the Hastings Center makes this statement. He's talking about using a carrot and a stick to guide people's behavior. And he said, the stick will be the message that you should take care of yourself and not expect medicine to save you when your time runs out. That is no longer an option. And it's interesting in the opening statement that's posted on the Hastings Center, this is what they say about life and death. They say death may not have changed, but dying is quite different from what it used to be, thanks to medical technologies that have extended life and made dying frequently a lingering process rather than a sudden event. People with failing kidneys can survive on dialysis for 20 years or more. People with incurable cancer can live for months or years with chemotherapy and radiation treatments. Victims of car accidents who would have died of head injuries can now be kept alive by ventilators and feeding tubes. Meantime, life-saving therapies for what were once sudden killers, like heart attack, mean that increasing numbers of us end up with chronic complications or decline into dementia. What I used as an example, I said that's like saying I'm not going to fix the fence because one day it's going to fall down anyway. So basically what he's saying, when someone's kidneys fail, why put them on dialysis or give them a kidney transplant and let them live 20 years only to die of something else, with no consideration that that's 20 years of good life for that person or life that they value or their family values. And that's because in the socialist Gnostic view, the individual doesn't matter. What matters is society, and society says, we don't want to spend the money on that person getting dialysis. We don't want to spend the money on that person treated for a heart attack. It would be better if they just died out right away, and it would save society as a whole, because we don't care about individuals. And this is the general theme you get reading all of these papers, and some of them make it quite plain, is that we've got to get over the idea that the individual matters. And, of course, that's an old concept from Marxism and Darwinism, is that it's society that matters, not individuals. So when you talk about someone's grandmother was denied care and died, and how sad this family was, to the socialist, that doesn't matter because it's an individual. What they care is, well, what is the success of the plan overall? Did we save money? Did we save costs? Did we move the money in areas that we thought it should be in? That's how they measure success.
But, of course, the whole idea is, do we believe in God or do we not believe in God? If you believe in God, then you think every human being is a unique individual made in the image and likeness of God, and that life is important. If you don't believe in God, then why not off them? Why not get rid of the infirmed and the disabled and certainly the elderly, who certainly are simply nothing more than a drain on society? And at one time, this would have been a horrid idea. Today, it's being increasingly embraced by our intellectuals. Well, you go right ahead, Russell.
Well, I talked to Dennis Cuddy and had some interesting conversations with him, and he led me to some books that he thought I would find of interest. And of course, I've read several of his books, which are all wonderful. But there's one by a sociologist named Edward Allsworth Ross, called Social Control. It's a very interesting book, but it's basically this idea, and it's written around 1905. But it's the idea that the leaders of a society have a responsibility to design a society and mold people to follow it, either by force or by other means. And he has an interesting section there, which I quote. He said, although the social fabric is at first held together by sheer force of arms, time gradually masks naked might, and moral and spiritual influences partly replace brute force. It is the composite society, then, where the need for control is most imperative and unremitting, that the various instruments of regulation receive their highest form and finish. Here has been perfected the technique of almost every kind of control. So he said, in order to maintain society, we've got to have control at all levels, even if it's deceiving the public. And so much of this is based on the concept that the public must never know what our true motives are. We have to deceive them. Rapid appearances of social good, so that the people will think that we care about them as individuals. Well, you see this throughout the writings from the 1700s up to present, that it's a matter of how we deceive and push these people to do what we want them to do. Now, if you look practically, just to get back to the practicality of this national health insurance, if you look at the national health insurance programs in the other countries, we see that all of them are in severe financial difficulty, and they stay in it.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Russell Playlot.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Blaylock was just saying that if you look at the socialized medical system in the other countries, they're always in a position of constant deficit. They just don't have enough money to do all the things that they promised to do, and so they have in one way or another to ration access to health care. You pick up the story there.
Well, in the early stages, the oldest one, of course, is the one in the United Kingdom, which was voted into law in 1948. Almost immediately, it was in financial trouble. And, you know, it was designed by a man by the name of Norman Bevan. And Bevan was a lot, as you would see with Obama. But Bevan, his biographer said, well, the thing about Anurag Bevan is he never concerned himself with cost. He was convinced that the problem in England was that people were sick and didn't have access to care, and once it was free, everybody would get well and the cost of health care would drop, which was, of course, completely naive, and instead what happens is a continuous escalation to the point it stayed in a point of bankruptcy ever since. And what happened in all of these countries, like Canada and Sweden and Netherlands and Australia, England, New Zealand, is that they realized that we're at a point where we're either going to have to declare national bankruptcy or we're going to have to end the system. They knew that politically they could never end the system. So what they've done, a lot of them are converting over slowly to at least partial private care. For instance, in England, they have a double system. You can buy private insurance, be treated in private hospitals. The most rapidly growing hospitals in England are the private hospitals. And, of course, they're the best equipped hospitals. And the National Health Service even pays patients to go to other countries to be hospitalized and treated. They're even trying to sell some of their hospitals, the National Health Hospitals, for use by private care to help make money. Canada does the same thing. They make $1 billion a year financial relief by sending their patients to the United States to be treated. So that saved them $1 billion a year. Plus, they make $500 million a year attracting Americans and other countries to go use their hospitals, you know, as private hospitals to get care and service that the Canadians cannot get. That's absolutely restricted from the Canadians. But they're selling it to outside populations just to help pay some bills. The Netherlands, a third of the health care is now private. And in Sweden, 80% of primary care is now private. So a lot of these socialist systems that they try to hold up as examples of successes, the only success is because there's a large measure of private care, or they're sending them to another country that has private care to take off the pressure. But still, the systems are abusing patients terribly. And some of the findings were incredible. For instance, the Observer newspaper in the United Kingdom did an investigative study and found out that the delay of colon cancer was so long that 20% of the cases were considered curable at the time they were diagnosed, were incurable by the time they were treated. That's 20% of colon cancer patients. In other words, it took so long for them to finally be treated that they went from curable to incurable. They found that 25% of cardiac patients die while waiting to be treated. So we're talking about large numbers here. One study in England found that there were 400 to 1,200 unnecessary deaths in one city alone caused by what they labeled as appalling care. People even starved to death in hospitals in England. Actually starved to death in the hospital. I had a person that I know in Louisiana whose daughter is a medical student, and went to England to work in the National Health Service because she wanted to see what it was really like. She became ill with pneumonia, was admitted to one of the National Health Hospitals. She laid there for 6 days, was never seen by a physician once, never got any medications for the entire 6 days. She was so sick, she called her mother. Her mother flew to England, picked her up, brought her back to Louisiana, had ambulances waiting to take her to the hospital. And this is how they treat a doctor, a resident who was working in their hospital. So if you're losing 400 to 1,000, 200 patients from appalling care in one city, if you multiply it times the 60 million population in England, you can see there's a lot of people that are dying that never end up in the statistics and that the American public is not hearing about. And that would be the monstrosity we would create in this country. One of the things they talk about a lot in this is that it's all about equity. It's allowing poor people and disadvantaged and uninsured access to health care that they've never had before. Well, they did studies in England to see was there equity in the National Health Service. 30 years after the formation of the National Health Service, the Black Report found little evidence that access was more equal. They raided the hospitals and found out that in London, the wealthier people and the better off were going to the best hospitals and had a much higher survival rate, and the poor had much poorer hospitals, and their death rate was about 43% higher than normal. 20 years after that, that is 50 years after the formation of the National Health Service, they found out access was even less equal. So it continues to deteriorate. In fact, they call it the postcode lottery, meaning where you live. You're playing a lottery as to whether or not you end up in a good hospital or a bad hospital. They found out that people that the non-elderly who were ending up in these poorly performing hospitals were 42% more likely to die on any given day in the UK as a whole. And in the best hospitals, they were 24% less likely to die. So there's huge disparities in your risk of dying, which supposedly was going to be erased by free health care. And instead we see that in fact it's worse than ever. The British Heart Association, or Foundation, found that premature death rate for working class men was 58% higher than white collar workers. So here again, it was sold on the basis that this is for the working man to make his treatment as good as that as the white collar worker. Here it is since 1948, and we find out it's actually worse than ever. When they examined the Canadian system for equity and disparity, they found the very same thing. The wealthier hospitals, the better hospitals, were located in wealthy neighborhoods. They had three times as many specialists as the poorer hospitals. So again, we didn't see the disappearance of this disparity that people were promised. And, of course, this is what really appeals to a lot of the poor people in America, is they have this vision they're going to get just as good a care as everyone else under the national health system, and that's going to be a lot better than the present system. Well, the present system, you can get the best top-level care if you can walk into or be driven to an emergency room. So there's, you know, I don't care if you have no insurance of any kind. You can get top-level care in every hospital in the United States, and that's by law. So when you hear these people stand up at these meetings screaming and hollering that 40, 50 million people don't have health care, equating that with the fact that they're uninsured, you know, that's nonsense. Everybody gets health care in the United States. Also, you know, another interesting story. I talked to a fellow in Canada whose father was a doctor, and he was in heart failure, and he was in one of the hospitals in Canada, and I was talking to him, and he said, I had this horrible experience with my father in the hospital. He collapsed in the hospital, and there was no one around to help him, and the elevators didn't work. And I said, well, yeah, it sounded like Canadian healthcare system pretty bad. He said, oh, all that's a myth. That's not true. He said, it's a good healthcare up here. And I said, well, what about all the long waiting periods, waiting a year and 2 years and being denied certain procedures? He said, well, you can get care immediately anywhere if you're in an emergency. And I said, well, that's anywhere in the world. We don't count that. We're counting hip replacements and cataract surgery. And he said, oh, well, if you want something extra, you're going to have to wait. And I said,
well, see, it's the best health care system in the world as long as you're not ill.
Well, that's right. And if it's an emergency, then you can go to the emergency room just like you can right now. But if you're chronically ill, or if you develop heart failure, or if you develop cancer, or you develop one of numerous diseases that need a hip replacement, you may wait 1 or 2 years. And like I said, I forgot a statistic, about 6% of people in the National Health Service that are on the waiting list are never seen. They just scratch them off the list. So, you know, we're talking about nightmares. In the paper that I sent you, I quote the case of the actress who was in Canada and injured in a skiing accident, had a head injury, and she began to deteriorate. So they drove her to a hospital for 2.5 hours in an ambulance, and she died. And they asked the head of the Canadian healthcare system, why wasn't a helicopter available, an air ambulance? And he said, oh, we don't have money for that. We have to think about the big picture. We can't allocate money for these sort of things. So this woman dies, this visitor to their country dies, because they didn't think it was worth the money to have air ambulances. Well, we have them all over the United States where people can get immediate care. And trauma surgeons talk about the golden hour. You have to get there quickly if you're going to be saved. But in a socialist system that's being offered as public option, they don't have money for that sort of thing. And so they allocate it for other things like sex education or teaching medical school. And one of the things that frightened me about this bill, it takes over medical education. It talks about putting instructors in medical school and having residency programs and setting curricula for the residents and the interns and the medical students. It's going to be a virtual takeover of all medicine, and then the doctors will be taught to practice medicine this way. All your effort is to go toward the young and the people with social utility and to push these other people aside. So if you have a generation of doctors that are trained by the federal government as to how to practice socialized medicine, I'm afraid you're going to see doctors that are quite different than what you're used to.
In fact, I was reading the other day where Dr. Emanuel had been very, very critical of the Hippocratic Oath, saying that the Hippocratic Oath was one of the big problems facing our society today because it taught people, the doctors, to value human life.
Exactly. He said doctors need to get over their love affair with the Hippocratic Oath. And that was in one of the papers he wrote for the Hastings Center. Because he thought this was an impediment to the idea we just need to let these people die. We need to quit treating them. Now, if the average elderly person and a person with a chronic disease or a potentially incurable disease knew this, they would be terrified. But unfortunately, this is hidden in an academic paper written in the Hastings Center. So they don't know that. And I think, you know, so many of the elderly are rather naive, and they just can't bring themselves to believe that America has changed so radically since their youth. But it is. It's a different country.
Well, you know, Russell, it was the hardest thing for me to believe there were really were people out there who wanted to eliminate large parts of the population. When I spent 10 years fighting the battle to try to use standard and effective public health measures to try to stop the spread of AIDS. This was started in 1986 and went up to about 1995. It wasn't really until about 1993 that I really began to realize there is a population control agenda. There really are people who want to eliminate large parts of our population because they think they're just too many people. And until people understand that, and people understand these are the ones who want the Obama health care bill, or as I like to refer to as the Kevorkian health care bill, why, they're not going to understand that Dr. Emanuel has come out firmly against the Hippocratic Oath. And fortunately, there's an article in the Wall Street Journal, of course, on the back pages where most people wouldn't read it. But basically, we need to understand these people hate medical tradition, and especially those medical traditions that require a physician to try to preserve human life. That is Dr. Emanuel, who will be in charge of the Obama health care program.
It's quite frightening, and I'm, you know, it distresses me that they have been so successful in convincing the public that these things aren't true, that what we're telling people is just scare stories. But we've been through all this before. You know, those of us that lived a number of years, we remember back when we were given assurances, oh, this bill doesn't mean that, that's just scare stories by its enemies. And then everything we said came true and more. That's almost with virtually every one of these socialist bills. You know, when Medicare started out, we warned of the effects of this intrusion of socialist medicine, and we were given all these assurances. Well, we've reached that nightmare, and as I tell some of my elderly people, I said, you don't know what a doctor goes through to provide you even with the simplest care. All the hoops he has to jump, his risk of being in prison for making a mistake during coding, all the phone calls and begging he has to do just to do the simplest thing for you. You know, on your side, you just see it happen. You don't know what your doctor went through. The sleepless nights wondering if the government's going to say he overcharged patients and plaster the paper with his name and charge him $400,000 in back payment and ruin him, destroy his savings and his retirement. You know, patients don't know what's happened just with what we have already.
And hold that thought, then it's going to be a lot worse with the Kevorkian health care bill. We'll be right back.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
We know America is changing, but most of the changes that are taking place seem to be designed to take away our freedom. And what can you do to remedy the current situation? Well, you can become informed, and one of the best ways to become informed is to subscribe to Republic Magazine, because that magazine provides the information that's suppressed in most other news magazines. If you want to oppose the effort to establish a one-world government, if you want to preserve freedom here in the United States and throughout the world, I suggest you subscribe to Republic Magazine, and you can do that by calling 1-800-873-1620. That's
800-873-1620 or access their website at www.republicmagazine.com. That's republicmagazine.com. I suggest you get extra copies for your family and your friends.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
There is the Christian, Judeo-Christian worldview, and as he calls it, the Gnostic worldview. And if you study Gnosticism, you'll understand that the Gnostics believe there were two gods. There is the God of the Bible, and then there's the God that they worship, who is Lucifer. And people say nobody in their right mind would worship Lucifer, and you're absolutely right. Nobody in their right mind would do it. But some of the most wealthy and powerful people in this country today have been richly rewarded for serving the Prince of Darkness. Certainly Thomas Edison was deeply involved in the occult, as was Henry Ford, as was J.P. Morgan, as are members of the Rockefeller family, are members of the Rothschild family, are members of the Mellons and the Whitneys, and all of these very, very wealthy people, Andrew Carnegie. When you understand that, so much of what's going on begins to make sense. Stephen Rockefeller, David Rockefeller's nephew, wrote the Earth Charter. If you haven't read it, it's available through Radio Liberty. If you get anything else, just ask for a free copy of the Earth Charter. It is the Mein Kampf for what's going on today. And then, of course, we have the pamphlet on the spiritual hierarchy, which we mentioned, which was channeled to Alice Bailey. You need to read it. She tells you about who really runs the world, about the wise men, the hierarchy that rules the world. Not imaginary, really very real. If you want the original pages from Barbara Marx Hubbard's book, The Revelation, the Book of Co-Creation, financed at the behest of Lawrence Rockefeller's Endowment for the Humanities, where Barbara Marx Hubbard talks about the necessity of killing a quarter of the world's population and then says, that's not your job, my dear. That is ours, for we are the writers of the Pale Horse Death. You need to get our information. The Brotherhood of Darkness is a good place to begin. My talk on the forbidden secret, my talk on the financial Armageddon, and of course there's syllabus that goes with all of these. You need to get the information. You have our permission to copy them. As far as certainly what's going on today, you need to get our four tape set on the swine flu vaccine. You need to understand that this is very, very dangerous, and they're going to give it to millions of people. And why would they do that? Well, you need to get my talk. It's called it's a DVD called Planned Population Reduction. You need to get my talk, None Dare Call It Genocide. You need to get the video of Population Control. You need to get our four tape set on Population Control. We'll explain to you about DDT. It was outlawed not because it was dangerous, but because it was saving too many human lives. And, of course, that's the same reason why they blocked the use of effective public health approaches to AIDS, because there are too many people in the world. And when you understand that, everything begins to make sense. So many of the things that certainly you wonder about, why we're really not trying to stop the spread of AIDS, why the World Health Organization just forgot to use clean needles when they did their worldwide vaccine program and 2 billion people contracted hepatitis B, and 60,000 die every year of hepatitis B. These people know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want you to know why so many people are dying of malaria.